My castaway this week is the singer-songwriter Graham Nash. He was a Salford teenager when he formed the Hollies with a childhood friend. They were spotted at the Cavern Club in January 1963, shortly after another Merseybeat combo had made the venue famous. Their foot-stomping sound took them to the top of the British charts, then to America, where his next adventure began. In Los Angeles, he was introduced to David Crosby of the Byrds and Stephen Stills from Buffalo Springfield. In the course of one life-changing, mind-altering evening, they formed Crosby, Stills and Nash. Their debut album spent over 100 weeks on the US Top 40, and their crystalline harmonies defined LA's Laurel Canyon sound in the late 1960s and early 70s. Though many of their biggest hits, including Our House and Marrakesh Express, were written by the lad from Lancashire. It was the start of a lifelong, shape-shifting creative journey for the band's founders and sometime collaborator Neil Young. Harmony on stage was a given. Off it, not so much, but the music endures and Graham Nash's musical progress continues. He's still touring at 81 and recently released his 7th solo album. He says, "The art of songwriting to people who enjoy music but don't write music is very mysterious. I wake up in the morning, I'm alive, I get on with my day and I write about my life. That's all I've been doing all my life." Graham Nash, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm extremely well. All the better for seeing you. And you are still making music, Graham, after almost 70 years. It's such an extraordinary achievement. How much has your songwriting changed in that time?
It changed when I started to hang out with David and Stephen. In the Hollies, I kind of learned how to write a melody that you probably couldn't forget if you'd heard it a couple of times. But the words left a lot to be desired. When I came to America and I saw what David was writing and what Stephen was writing and what Joni was writing and what Neil was writing, I decided that if I put better words to my melodies, I'd have better songs. And that's when my songwriting changed.
I mean, such an extraordinary high bar to set yourself, keeping up with your contemporaries, as you say, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young. You yourself have written some monster hits. Do you know it in the moment when you've written a song like that that's going to connect?
The only thing I know is that I want to not waste your time with a song. And when I've written a song like Our House, because of my experience with the Hollies, I knew it was going to be a radio hit.
It must have meant so much to you. You wrote it for Joni Mitchell.
I did. And Joni was the only witness to the beginnings of Crosby, Stills and Nash. I had come to Los Angeles to spend 3 or 4 days with Joni. I got to the parking lot. There were other voices in the house, and that kind of upset me a little, you know. I just wanted to be with Joan. But it was David and Stephen, and they were having dinner with Johnny. And after dinner, David said to Stephen, "Hey, play Willie, that song that we were just doing." And because the Buffalo Springfield had broken up and because David had been thrown out of the Byrds, they were trying to get like a duo kind of thing together, like an Everly Brothers kind of thing. And they had this song that they sang called "You Don't Have to Cry," which is on the first record. And I said, "Do me a favour, sing it again." When they finished the second time, I said, "Trust me, do me a favour, just sing it for the third time." When we started the song and I added my harmony, after 45 seconds, we had to stop and laugh. We were all in bands that were pretty decent harmony bands, but this was completely different. It had a magic to it immediately. And so the sound, whatever sound that is, of Crosby, Stills and Nash was born in 45 seconds.
Graham, you're joining me today to share the 8 tracks that you'd take away to a desert island. What's your first choice?
I'm going to start out with a record that really changed my life in many ways. It's Bebopalula by Gene Vincent. It was the first record I ever bought. It was a 78, which I'm sure there are many people out there who have no idea what a 78 is. And I traded it with my friend Fred Marsden for 4 pieces of toast. I would always bring a toast for a lunchtime snack, and he liked my toast, and we made a deal. I got the record, he got my toast. Gene Vincent, this record is an amazing record.
Well, Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean my baby. Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean my baby. be ba ba loo loo she. My baby, well, she's the gal in the red blue jeans. She's the queen of all the teens. She's the woman that I know. She's the woman that loves me so. Say, be ba ba loo loo, she's my baby. Be ba ba loo loo, I don't mean my baby. Be ba ba loo loo, she. My baby, let's rock. She's the one with the flying feet. She's the one that walks around the store. She's the one that yells more, more, more. Be ba ba loo, she's my baby.
Gene Vincent and Be Ba Ba Loo, well worth those pieces of toast.
Yes, it's a nice song to start off with.
So let's go back to the beginning then, Graham Nash. You were born in Blackpool in 1942 to Mary and William, brought up in Salford. When you think back to those early days, what is it that you remember?
I remember rationing, where you had to have a coupon to be able to even buy basic, you know, bread and milk and stuff. I remember collecting pieces of coal at the rubbish dump, filling my sister's pram with coal for the fire. I have very warm feelings about Salford. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that it was a slum. Nobody had any money, you know, and maybe we had a ball to kick around, you know, but I didn't know I lived in a slum.
That post-war picture that you paint, it would have been heavily bombed in the area. Were you playing on bomb sites and that?
Absolutely.
Kind of... Tell me about music. I mean, how old were you when you realised that you had a voice that you could sing?
When I was six. I was sitting in class, Mr. Burke's class, and the door opened and an older lady with this young boy came in. And Mr. Burke said, this is Harold Clark, and they're moving here, and where can he sit? There was this seat next to me that was empty, and he came and sat next to me, and me and Alan became friends, and we would sing in the school choir, and we'd sing the Lord's Prayer. For some reason, Alan always took the melody, and for some reason, I always took the harmony.
For the two of you, long before you formed the Hollies, you started in
yes,
church?
Yes, yes. Alan had a brother. His name was Frank. And he said, you know, I see that what you're doing, you're a couple of guitars and you're doing all this skiffle stuff and stuff. He says, you know, there's a sportsman's club. Maybe you can go and just play a couple of songs. And we went down there and we did, I think, three skiffle songs. And they loved us. And at the end of that, Bill Benny took this incredibly large roll of pound notes, £5 notes, £10 notes, out of his pocket, and he gave us each 10 shillings. And we just sang. We had a great time singing, and we got paid for it.
Your eyes were still wide at the memory, I should
Whoa.
Say, for our listeners. So that was a really important moment for
it
you.
It was.
Tell me about your mum, Mary, when you remember her. What kind of parent was she?
Incredibly proud of her son. I had two sisters, my sister Elaine and my sister Sharon. She was the reason that we're talking right now, because if she had not encouraged my passion for music, I don't know what I'd done with my life.
Where do you think that came from in her? Because she must have been struggling to bring the three of you up in the circumstances you describe.
It's very interesting. I asked my mother that very question, and she said she wanted to be a singer. She wanted to be on stage. But she married my father, she had three kids, you know, la, la, la. She never got to fulfil her dream.
It's time for some more music on the programme now. I want to talk more about your early life next, though, Graham. Disc number two, what are we going to hear and why are you taking it to your desert island today?
We're going to hear one of the best rock and roll songs from that age. Jerry Lee Lewis was a madman. I've seen and experienced in real life his passion and his incredible energy in terms of making music. So what we're going to hear now, Great Balls of Fire by Jerry Lee Lewis.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I let you love what I thought it was funny. You came along and woo, now honey, I've changed my mind. This love is fine. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. Kisses, baby. Feels good. Hold me, baby. Well, I want to love you like I love a should. Oh, you're fine. So kind. Got to tell this world that you're mine, 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 mine. I chew my nails and then I twiddle my thumb. I'm real on earth, but it sure is fun. Come on, baby. It drives me crazy. It's just great balls of fire.
Great Balls of Fire, Jerry Lee Lewis. So, Graham Nash, your dad William was a keen amateur photographer when you were growing up, I think. Did he have a dark room at home?
Yes, in a way. He would take a blanket off my bed and put it up against the window and tape it down to block out the light. I always will remember the very moment that I fell in love with the photography. My father would take me and my younger sister, Elaine, but he would take us to Bellevue Zoo in Manchester, and he would take pictures. And he put a blank piece of paper into a colourless liquid, and he'd say, wait. And there, fading into existence, was a photograph of me and my sister that my father had taken that morning, and it changed my life. It was a piece of magic that I remember to this day.
And photography was your first creative passion, and that continues in your life. You have a very successful career as a photographer in parallel to your work as a musician. I know that your dad bought you your first camera when you were 10, but what should have been a lovely birthday present for you had some terrible consequences for the family. What exactly happened?
My father did give me this little small Agfa camera. Had a tiny and had a little bellows and stuff. But then the police came to the door, and that was shocking. And they told my father that the camera that he had bought from his friend at work that he gave to me had been stolen, and who was it that sold him the camera? And my father would not tell them. And they put him in jail for a year, and he died at 47.
And as a child, you know, to experience that, it must have just been devastating. What do you remember about your own feelings? I think the news was just delivered to you, you know, that dad wasn't coming home.
The only thing that I always remember was my father talking to me at bedtime and telling me that he would have to go away for a year. He didn't tell me why. I was only 13, 14 maybe. My father never spoke a word about his time in strange ways.
Could you see the change in him, though, when he came home?
Yeah, I think he was feeling a lot of shame, feeling that he had let his family down, feeling that his life was never going to be the same. And in fact, it wasn't. Mm. But it did affect me as a person. I've always appreciated the underdog. I've always rooted for the team that's not supposed to win but does. I hate injustice. My passion against injustice comes from what happened to my father.
And that makes its way into many of your songs.
Yes.
And what about your mum? How did she cope? I mean, it must have been incredibly difficult to make ends meet.
I remember her leaning against the wall and telling me that my father had been sentenced to a year in jail. She was crying, of course. I tried my best to help her over this emotional trauma that she was going through. I would always do the best I could to help her throughout the day. I always did the dishes. I tried to help my mother as much as I could.
Did music and culture at the time provide an escape from what was going on?
Absolutely. It saved my life and still does to this day.
Well, Graham Nash, I think we'd better hear your next disc on that note. Number 3, what is it?
We were the Hollies. We were named after Buddy Holly. He was one of us. He wore a suit and tie and he had glasses. He wasn't like Elvis, who slicked his hair back and shake his backside and stuff. He wasn't one of those. He was one of us. I remember so distinctly when Alan and I heard that he had died. We were both absolutely crying on the street. So why don't we hear Maybe Baby by Buddy Holly?
Maybe, baby, I'll have you. Maybe, baby, you'll be. Maybe, baby, I'll have you for me. It's funny, honey, you don't care. You never listen to my prayer. Maybe, baby, you will love me someday. Well, you are the one that makes me glad, and you are the one that makes me sad. When someday you want me, well, I'll be there, wait and see. Maybe, baby, I'll have you. Maybe, baby, you'll be true. Maybe, baby, I'll have you for me. Well, you are the one that makes me glad, and you are the one that makes me sad. When someday you want me, well, I'll be there, wait and see. Maybe, baby,
Buddy Holly and the Crickets with Maybe Baby. Graham Nash, as we've heard, at school, you and Alan formed a duo. You then expanded your lineup and became the Four Tones.
So then we had me and Alan and Pete Bocking and Joe Abrams, who was the drummer, and we needed a bass player. So we got Butch Mepham, great bass player. Then we were the Four Tones, even though there were five of us. we didn't quite understand that, but anyway...
So you were off and gigging and already getting quite good bookings by the sounds of it. I mean, I wonder what your school friends made of what you were up to, your aspirations. Did you sing at school? Did you have a bit of a name for yourselves?
I'll be honest with you. If you did know two or three chords and you could play a guitar at a party, you know, the girls would be much more interested in you.
At what point did your horizons start to expand? What were you dreaming of in the first place when you and Alan first started to play together? How big were your dreams?
The only dream we had was that we would get paid for doing what we would do naturally anyway. We would have done it for nothing, and we did often play shows for free. But we knew that that's what we wanted to do. So we didn't have any dreams about going to America and stuff like that until later, because we were just thrilled that someone would pay us to sing.
It's time for some more music. Your next disc today, if you wouldn't mind, Graham Nash. Number four, what have you got for us and why have you chosen it?
I was, I think, 15 years old, and me and Alan were going to a Catholic schoolgirls' dance on a Saturday night, and Bye Bye Love by the Everly Brothers came on loud. And it stunned me and Alan. We knew that me and him could sing together, but the blend that Don and Phil had was profoundly deep, and it was DNA. They came from the same mother. That song changed my life. It made me want to do that more than we were doing. I think we still remember that moment to this day.
Bye-bye, my love, goodbye. There goes my baby with someone new. She sure looks happy, I sure am blue. She was my baby till he stepped in. Goodbye to romance that might have been. Bye-bye, love. Bye-bye, happiness. Hello, loneliness. I think I'm gonna cry. Bye-bye, love. Bye-bye, sweet caress. Hello, emptiness. I feel like I could die. Bye-bye, my love, goodbye. I'm through with romance. I'm through with love. I'm
the counting the stars above. And here's the reason that I'm so free. My loving baby is through with me.
The Everly Brothers and Bye Bye Love, a track, Graham Nash, that you said changed your life. Did you ever see them live, meet them?
They played in the Free Trade Hall in Manchester, 1962. And Alan and I decided two things. One, we would go to the concert. But two, we would meet them. The best hotel in Manchester, or one of them, the Midland Hotel, was only 100 yards away. So we kind of figured that that's where they were staying. And we waited. And we waited, and just after 1 o'clock in the morning, they came round the corner. They stood and talked to me and Alan for what seemed like 20 minutes to me. It may have only have been, you know, 2 minutes. They called me Graham, and they called Alan Alan, and we said, you know, we sing together, and one day we'd really love to make records, and, you know, they patted us on the head, and that was it. 3 years later, the Hollies were playing at the London Palladium, and they were playing Sunday night. After we did our sound check around 4:30, the telephone rang, and our road manager, Rod Shields, picked up the phone. He goes, yeah? Uh-huh. Yeah, he's right here. And he starts to hand me the phone, and I go, who is it? He said, it's Phil Everly. I said, hey, that's not nice. You can't. What are you doing joking like that? He said, hey, it's Phil Everly. And he goes, hey, Graham, Don and I are in town. We're about to start a record called Two Yanks in England. And do the Hollies have any songs that they haven't recorded yet? And we did. So they said, come on down to the hotel. And I think they were staying at the Ritz here in London. We went down to the hotel. We played them a bunch of songs. They chose, I think, 6 songs to sing. And we said, OK, we'd like to help you with this. When are you going to start the record? And he said, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And so we went and we helped him record our songs. And part of the backing band was a pianist called Reggie Dwight.
Elton John.
Yeah. And Jimmy Page on guitar and John Paul Jones on bass. Oh. And they made Two Yanks in England.
Wow. What a moment for you.
Really?
I wonder what your parents made of your success in the Hollies, Graham, because, you know, things took off very quickly for you guys once you got that deal.
They were very proud, particularly my mother, because she knew what my passion was for music. And I always carried a little container of my mother's ashes. And I've always sprinkled a little of her ashes in the places where I think she would have wanted to sing had she become a singer in her dreams.
Oh.
Carnegie Hall, the Royal Albert Hall, and a couple of other places.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah.
She made it in the end.
Don't tell anybody, okay?
Don't worry. I won't tell anybody. Your secret's safe with me. It's time for some more music, I think, Graham Nash. Your fifth choice today, if you would. What is it?
When you were putting out albums originally, what it was basically a way for the record company to make more money. And what they would do is they put on 8 A-sides and then 4 B-sides, and they would put a record out, right? But it was the Beatles and the Beach Boys, particularly Brian Wilson, of course, who realised that an album could be a journey. It didn't have to be just chock full of singles to make money for the record company. It could be a journey. And the Beach Boys had done a record called Pet Sounds, and it was brilliant. So why don't we hear a great song from the Beach Boys? This is also one of the best records in the world. God Only Knows.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on, believe me. The world could shine. you're nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
The Beach Boys and God Only Knows. Graham Nash, you were one of the first British artists to leave the UK and live in America. The place had captivated you from the very beginning. You teamed up with David Crosby and Stephen Stills to form Crosby, Stills and Nash. And you've described that kind of quality in your voices, that within under a minute, you knew that life had changed for all of you forever. You had to sing together. And that must have been such a pivotal moment, but at the same time, a really difficult one, because you were in a band with your childhood friend.
Yes.
How did you break it to Alan that you were leaving the Hollies?
I didn't have the courage. I was a coward. I had Ron Richards tell him.
Oh.
I knew it was going to be difficult. As a musician, I had fallen in love with the sound that the three of us had created. And at that moment, I knew that I'd had to go back to England and leave my band and leave my equipment and my money and go to America and follow that sound. And that's what I did. It was very awkward for me and Alan. He was my best friend then. I'd known him since, as you know, since I was 6 years old. We had done all this singing and started the Hollies in December of 62 and made all those records, and it was very awkward for me.
Mm.
But I wanted that sound.
Did you feel guilty?
Yes.
So you had a musical partnership that you had to pursue. Crosby, Stills and Nash, obviously, and then Neil Young. And the collaboration between the three, sometimes four of you, actually sometimes two of you, because you and David Crosby made records together, was so creatively fruitful and long-standing. But you were all huge personalities. How did the creative process work? What was an average day like?
There was a huge difference between the first Crosby, Stills and Nash record and Deja Vu. Basically, it was this. When we made the first record, I was in love with Joni and living with her in Los Angeles. David was in love with his girlfriend, Christine. Stephen was in love with Judy Collins. A year later, when we're doing Deja Vu, I'm no longer with John. Stephen and Judy had broken up and Christine had been killed in a car accident. So it was darker.
Mm.
And we had Neil. He was funny. He was dark. And at the end of breakfast, he looked me in the eye and said, because I looked him in the eye, and I said, why should we invite you into this band? And he looked at me and he said, you ever heard me and Stephen play guitar together? I said, yes. He said, that's the reason you need me in this band. And I agreed. And so it became Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
It was just the most incredible adventure for all of you. But often, you know, offstage, drug problems, alcohol problems came to the fore and caused difficulties. Crosby in particular had serious substance abuse issues. And I think, as you mentioned, he lost his girlfriend. She was killed in a car accident. And that really put him in a very difficult place. How did the other band members and how did you as a friend deal with that? Because I know that you were particularly close, the two of you.
I needed to really be with him, support him. And we decided that we would go around the world and drink ourselves to death. We had a favourite drink, which was, strangely enough, was Courvoisier and Coca-Cola. Strange. I stayed with him. Because I knew that he had a very short grip on life, you know, and I knew how desperately he felt because Christine had been killed. So I just wanted to support him, you know. I wanted to be his friend, and that's what we did. We went drinking around the world.
You took a boat trip together, and I'm thinking you wrote the song To the Last Whale.
Yes,
I think that's, you know, in a way, you wondering about him and trying to figure him out as a person. It must have been incredibly hard to support him.
Yeah, it was,
during
it,
that time.
It was difficult. We went from Fort Lauderdale to San Francisco through the Panama Canal and up the coast all the way to San Francisco. 9 weeks. I'd never sailed before in my life. I put my life in his hands. Crosby was an unbelievable captain of a ship. When we got to San Francisco, we started to make deja vu. It was a magic time, and when I wanted to make sure that David understood that I was his friend and I was going to love him and support him.
Did you understand him, do you think? Did you ever figure him out? He sounds like a pretty complicated person.
I don't think anybody figured Crosby out, not even Crosby. He was also a profound individual who could light up a room with a sentence and kill everybody with another sentence a minute later.
Graham, let's have some more music. It's disc number 6.
Next, I'm going to choose a classical piece of music that I've always loved. It always puts me in an incredible mood, as most great music does. I've always loved the feeling inside of me when I listen to this. So why don't we play the Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber.
Barber's Adagio for Strings with the City of London Sinfonia, conducted by Richard Hickox. Graham, you've chronicled your life in photography, and alongside creating a fine art printing company, many of the images that you've taken have become part of the rock photography canon because of the access you've had. Do you have a favourite shot?
I think that one of Crosby is my favourite shot. He looks incredibly young and very handsome, and he had no idea. And once again, the look in his eye, I know deeply what he's thinking. And I want to be invisible. I don't want people to know that I'm taking that picture.
Has photography helped you understand yourself?
I had a show of my self-portraits in Berlin. I was in the gallery. A lady comes up to me and she says, "You know something? You should have your head examined." She said, "Yeah, look at all these self-portraits. There's never one of them where I can see your face. They're distorted, they're reflections in broken mirrors. They're not straightforward portrait of myself." And she said, "You better get your head examined."
Did you?
No. I do have a therapist. A lot of people in New York have a therapist. Mm-hmm. And I'm no different than anybody else. I need someone to talk to occasionally. And so every week I talk to my therapist.
It's time to go to the music. Graham Nash, we've got to make room for your 7th disc. What are we going to hear next?
Peter Gabriel is a fantastic musician. A brilliant, brilliant record maker. He did a song called "Don't Give Up" with Kate Bush. And I've loved it since the moment I heard it. And if anybody out there has something that they would love to do, don't let anybody put you off. Don't let anybody dissuade you from doing what you love.
In this proud land we grew up strong. We were wanted all along.
Don't Give Up, Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush. Graham Nash, you're still writing, still performing and taking pictures at 81. Can you imagine a time when you might step back and put your feet up?
My feet are always up. I love what I do. That's the thing about, you know, don't give up. I love what I do. You know, don't let anybody stop you. Mm. If you have something that you love, get to it. Do it.
Well, I appreciate that for you, the day job might not feel like work, but you're still embracing changes and new experiences. I mean, in recent years, you've married for a third time, you've relocated to New York. You know, a lot of people in their 70s would find that kind of upheaval quite difficult, but it seems like you really relish it.
I do. I can't do anything about the past. You can't buy a second of time. Even Bill Gates and Zuckerberg can't buy a second of time.
And you talked about using time wisely and the importance of embracing it. I wonder, for you, when are you happiest? What's the best use of your time?
I love that feeling within me that I've created a song. And I love the feeling inside me when I think I've created a great photograph.
Will you sing on your desert island, do you think, Graham?
Absolutely.
Well, one more disc before we cast you away, Graham Nash. What's it going to be? Final choice today.
A programme like this needs to be a journey. And we have made the journey from the early 50s all the way through to today. I want to end up with one of the greatest songs that was ever written. It's incredibly profound. Let's finish off this show with A Day in the Life by the Beatles.
A Day in the Life by the Beatles. So, Graham Nash, I'm going to send you away to the island now. I'm giving you the books, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to take with you. And you can have one other of your own choice. What will it be?
I just finished a book called The Island at the Center of the World, and it's a history of Manhattan from 1600 to the present day. And it's a brilliant, brilliant book about exactly what happened and why all the politics was all moved to Washington, D.C., and why New York was only a center made for making money. So it's an incredibly beautiful book by a man called Russell Shorto called The Island at the Center of the World.
It sounds like quite a good place for someone with such an enormous drive to be at the stage of life you're at.
Yeah. I'm lucky to be alive. Who knows when I'll pass? But you know what? When they're putting the coffin lid down, I'll still be writing.
You can also have a luxury item to take with you to the desert island, Graham. What would you like?
I'd want a great sleeping bag.
Oh, a sleeping bag. Tell me more. Are you an outdoorsy person?
Not at all. No way.
Okay.
No.
Just a luxury sleeping bag of some
yes,
style.
Just to protect myself at night so I can sleep well.
Oh, yeah, I can do that. I'll even throw in a quality camping mattress for you.
Fantastic.
Finally, which one track of the eight that you've shared with us today would you rush to save from the waves first if you had to?
A Day in the Life. It's the greatest song that was ever written, I think.
Graham Nash, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs
with us.
You're
very, very welcome. Thank you.